Good morning, everyone. 9 o'clock here. Welcome all to our Gloucester Council meeting. Action-packed, fun-filled 3 days. Many things to do today. Just want to kick off a couple things here. As always, we are on our relatively new platform, Zoom. If anyone is having any problems, definitely contact staff. Let us know. Make sure everyone's working. I just want to remind everyone, it's helpful if you're raising hands to do it on the computer, so that way I'm not trying to look around all around. So it would be just remind everyone that way. Couple things want to point out. New folks around the table here today. We have our new Mid-Atlantic liaison, Robert Rule, down in the corner there, taking Peter Hughes' spot. We have our new council member, soon to be sworn in, Andy D'Angelo over here. We have another new Coast Guard rep here. Captain John Singletary will be giving the report today, assisted by Lieutenant Blyfus. Tony Kearns will not be here today. She will be doing her report remotely, but I believe she'll be here for the next 2 days. And John Papalardo, council member, will not be here. He will be working remotely today. A few other things to note. We do have our public outreach tonight. Just to let you know, our office administrator will be in present, Sharon, so anyone will be welcome. Come say hello to her. And just as our typical September council meeting, we've got a few things before we get at it. So we're going to start off with the swearing in of new and reappointed members. Our new member, as I pointed out, is Andy D'Angelo, and we'll be reappointing Peter Whalen and Eric Hansen. So I will kick it over to Mr. Pentney.
Thank you, Chair. If I could ask Eric, Peter, and Andy to stand up, and we can go through the oath. And so if you just follow along with me and state your name where it says state your name, then we'll be able to get you all sworn in. So just read along with me. I.
Andy D'Angelo.
Peter Whalen.
As a duly appointed member of a regional fishery management council established under the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. Hereby promise to conserve and manage the living marine resources of the United States of America by carrying out the business of the Council for the greatest overall benefit of the nation. I recognize my responsibility to serve as a knowledgeable and experienced trustee of the nation's marine fisheries resources, being careful to balance competing private or regional interests and always aware and protective of the public interest in those resources. I commit myself to uphold the provisions, standards, and requirements of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act and other applicable law, and shall conduct myself at all times according to the rules of conduct prescribed by the Secretary of Commerce. This oath is given freely and without mental reservation or purpose of evasion. Thank you and congratulations. You're all re-sworn in and newly sworn in members.
Thank you for that, and welcome again. As always, our next part of our morning agenda here is I will kick it over to Attorney McDonald for our elections of 2025 through 2026 officers. Just to remind everyone, the process is outlined in our Council Operations Handbook on page 14. So I will kick it over to Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll go over those procedures in summary form anyways, as we move through the election process. Today we will be electing the council officers. This happens every year after the first regularly scheduled council meeting after the new council appointments become effective each year. The council elects officers from among the voting members of the council, and they are elected for 1 year and may be reelected. So we will be electing a chair and a vice chair, and then we will be moving on to the executive committee. And I'll get into the details of the executive committee at that time. So the way this will proceed is I will open up the floor for nominations for the particular office, starting from the chair. When the floor is open, anybody can make a nomination, and I will hold it open until everyone who wants to make a nomination makes the nomination. Then I'll close the nomination period, and we will vote if there are more than one candidate for the positions that are up And if you happen to be nominated and you prefer not to be a member of that club, you may reject the nomination. You have that right. And otherwise, the elections will be done by secret ballot. People have ballots that are around at their place setting, and you can vote for the candidate that you want to vote for. No write-in candidates, please. And there are no absentee ballots. Mr. Popolato is attending the meeting remotely, so he will be emailing his votes to me, and we will count those with the other votes if there are votes. So with that, I will open up the nominations for the chair position.
Renee.
Thank you, Mr. Acting Chair. I would like to nominate Dan Salerno for the chair position. He's done an excellent job leading us in the interim and very prepared, very mindful about discussions and making sure he's doing his due diligence. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other nominations? Seeing none, Dan is the new chair by acclamation. Okay, so now I'm opening the floor to nominations for the vice chair position. Megan?
Thank you. I'd like to nominate Melanie Griffin for vice chair.
Any other nominations? Seeing none, I'm closing the nomination period for the vice chair. And Melanie, congratulations by acclamation. Okay, so now we're moving on to the executive committee. The executive committee is made up of five members. It's the chair and the vice chair, so we've taken care of two of the positions. And I'll give Melanie a chance to accede to the throne. We will be taking up nominations for the remaining three positions. And if there are more than three nominations, we will hold an election. And I will go over those procedures in short order after that. So with that, I am going to open up the floor for nominations for the three at-large, but not in charge, executive committee members. Okay. Dan.
For the sake of continuity and help me in my new leadership role, I would like to bring back John Popolato and Megan Ware at this time.
Okay, other nominations? Megan?
I'd like to nominate Jeff Smith.
Peter?
I'd like to nominate Mike Pierdonk.
Okay. Any other nominations? Bill?
I'd like to nominate Ted Platts.
Other nominations? Okay, I'm going to close the floor to nominations. So we have five candidates for the three at-large positions. And so the way that this will happen is that you will write in your votes on the ballots that you have. Scott and I will go and collect the ballots and tabulate them in a secret meeting room out in the back. And then we'll bring back the results. The top three vote getters will be the individuals who will join the committee. If there are ties, we will vote on the tied ballots, on the tied candidates to break the tie at that time. So with that, please go ahead and begin to write in your votes on your ballot forms, and then after a few moments, we'll come around and collect them.
I think, please stand by, I don't think we have our ballots in hand yet.
Yeah, we do.
We do? Oh, I don't have my ballots.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, vote for three. Yeah. Feel free to talk amongst yourselves. Mr. Chair, I have the election results. Okay. So we do have three clear votes for the three positions. And Megan Ware and John Pappalardo and Michael Pierdnock will be the three at-large executive committee members. So congratulations. And these ballots will remain at the office for 30 days, and then after that are disposed of. So thanks. At the council office.
Thank you, Attorney McDonald, and welcome to the new XCOM. Thank you for the large interest this year. You know, I haven't seen more than three names since I think maybe my first year on the council, so it's great to know that there's a lot of interest in participating in the leadership role here. On to reports. I guess the first report comes from me as your new chair here. Just a couple things I want to point out. XCOM met back in September 4th, earlier this month. Bunch of topics to go through. So the two major topics that bubbled up was obviously talking about our executive order and the management flexibility framework, both of which will be discussed and finalized, I believe, today. You'll probably get more information from Dr. O'Keefe as she goes through her report. A couple things to note. I know there's some concern about potential government shutdown. Just to let you know that if there is a government shutdown, council actually still does work. We will just go through with whatever meetings we have. We just won't have our federal partners with us at the table. Also, you'll note in your pile of papers, well, my pile of papers is bigger, you do have your committee assignment requests. Obviously, I think it was up to five. Put your, obviously, your most favorite first, then just kind of work your way back to least favorite. Dr. O'Keefe and I will be going through that after, I believe, next week to kind of go through this process to set up the committees for everyone that's interested. But that will probably take a few days after the council meeting because we also will be in Halifax next week. But we will be getting that out as soon as we can back to everyone so they can prepare for their assignments for this year. That's about all I have here. If there's no questions, I can kick it over to Dr. O'Keefe for her executive director report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations to Dan as our new chair and Melanie as our new vice chair and the executive committee. I look forward to working with all of you over the next year. Before I get going on my report, I wanted to recognize that we, over the summer, we had some losses to our scallop community. Kirk Larson Sr. passed on August 25th. Kirk was a longtime scallop advisory panel member. He contributed to nearly 30 years of scallop management with the New England Council, and he also served as the mayor of Barnegat Light, New Jersey, for decades. We also recently lost, on September 13th, Ray Starvish Jr. Ray was a previous scallop advisory panel member from New Bedford. He participated for decades in cooperative research surveys with the University of Massachusetts through the RSA program. And finally, I want to mention Jordan Hansen, who passed on July 25th. Jordan was Eric Hansen's grandson and grew up in the Fairhaven, Massachusetts region. So I just want to recognize some difficult losses to our scallop community this summer. So starting in on my report, next slide, please. Advisory panel solicitation is currently open. This closes. The deadline for applications is October 3rd. This is for the term that would start January 1st, 2026, running through December 31st, 2028. It's a full three-year term. This is a full turnover, so we want to make sure that the word is out. We have been receiving applications, but But I know people like to procrastinate, and we expect a slug towards the end of the application period here. Anyone who's on an AP, you do need to reapply. This is a full turnover for a brand new term. The information can be found on our website. The link is there. As always, we're seeking a range of expertise from the commercial and recreational fisheries, variety of gear types, broad geographic range, and generally contributions that can be made to our fishery management plans. Next slide. A couple of staff updates. As the chair recognized, our administrative officer, Sharon Ferrant, is joining us today. She's in the audience. Sharon, just give a wave. There's Sharon. Please introduce yourself. Sharon's the one that pays the bills and gets you all travel reimbursed, so please feel free to introduce yourself to Sharon. Also, I want to welcome, we have a new staff coming on board starting on October 14th, Mr. Mark Grant, who is coming to us from GARFO. We're very excited about it. Mark has been working in fisheries for over 20 years. He will be working as a senior fishery analyst on the council staff, starting with a focus on groundfish and climate-ready fisheries planning. We just wanted to make this announcement before Mark started, as there will be a transition. Mark is currently supporting our groundfish plan development team as a member of the regional office staff, and so we'll be transitioning to council staff in a couple of weeks. Next slide. For a financial update, the major update from the last council meeting is that we did receive our final drop of funds for fiscal year 2025. We received just over $1.5 million on August 20th. This takes us up to about 99% of our expected fiscal year 25 funding, so we are fully funded through fiscal year 25 based on what we had proposed. That's positive news. However, there's a lot of budget uncertainty going into fiscal year 26. The fiscal year starts on October 1st. As the chair mentioned, we are in preparation for potential federal shutdown and uncertainty around what the budget may be for the councils moving forward. We continue to work through our no-cost extension of our 2020 through 2024 cooperative agreement. That will end at the end of December. We're on track to spend those funds down and complete all of the work that was in the proposed scope. And we're still working through Inflation Reduction Act projects. The end date for that total grant is March 31st, 2027. Next slide. We are updating some of our travel and stipend policies, and this really is reflective of that budget uncertainty that I mentioned. Couple of reminders that travel is limited to the least expensive means of transportation appropriate. If travel arrangements are not made by the requested deadline from our staff, then travelers may need to make their own arrangements, and they may be responsible for any additional costs associated with late travel booking. Overnight lodging requests will be reviewed based on mileage. Right now we have a 50-mile radius. We are looking at things that fall just outside that radius in terms of start times and end times of meetings to ensure that we are trying to be as cost effective as we can. And meals are reimbursed for actual expenses despite the fact that there is a per diem maximum. And as a reminder, alcoholic beverages are not reimbursable. We'll be making a change to our stipend policy. Right now, council members may only claim a single daily stipend within a 24-hour period. There's no change to that, but we will be moving to half-day stipends. These will be for both travel days as well as, you know, meetings when business travel is completed in less than 5 hours. Really, this is focused on webinar meetings, where we have moved to some more webinar meetings. We will continue to use webinar meetings as a tool to reduce costs. And a webinar meeting that's, you know, 4 hours long, we're trying to save some of our costs, and we would be moving to half-day stipends. So just some new policies. Happy to talk to anyone, and staff would help with any questions that people have with these changes moving forward. Next slide. A couple of updates on some recent meetings, interagency meetings and gatherings. The U.S.-Canada Steering Committee had an intersessional meeting on July 21st. Really, the point there was to plan towards the U.S.-Canada process for 2025, the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee meeting next week. TMGC had this informational session a couple of days later, looking at the scientific information that's supporting this year's negotiations. The Council Coordination Committee, CCC, executive directors had a meeting on August 6th to try to plan for our upcoming October meeting. Really, the focus there is trying to look at aligning council and NOAA high-level priorities moving into 2026. The council staff had a stock assessment training course in the middle of August. There was 8 participants from the council staff that spent a week learning about stock assessment. The Northeast Region Coordinating Council, NRCC, held an intersessional meeting on August 20th to determine the 2026 stock assessment schedule. And the fall management track assessment peer review occurred last week. Next slide. Just a bit more information on that NRCC intersessional meeting. I mentioned that this is where the 2026 stock assessment schedule was determined. You can see the schedule here. There's one research track assessment, which is going to be completed in early 2026 for longfin inshore squid. There will be 3 management tracks peer-reviewed in June of 2026, Atlantic herring, haddock from our New England managed stocks, and then longfin inshore squid. That will be the follow-up management track after the research track is completed, and a couple of stocks in September, American Place and Gulf of Maine haddock. We also anticipate receiving data updates for Atlantic halibut, our whiting species, the red and silver hakes, and witch flounder, as well as data updates with projection updates for us, pollock, and then for mid-Atlantic managed species, butterfish and ocean quahog. We have a scheduled meeting in November of the NRCC to really start discussions about planning for 2027 and beyond, and thinking about maybe simplifying, streamlining some of our overarching assessment processes, trying to understand how we can fit in assessment schedules under kind of reduced regional capacity. Next slide. Some upcoming meetings that will happen before we all meet again as a council. As I mentioned, TMGC will be meeting next week. There is a pre-TMGC U.S. public listening session scheduled for this Friday morning. U.S.-Canada Steering Committee will follow up on the TMGC advice in the middle of October. The CCC meets, this is a virtual meeting, October 15th and 16th. The NRCC, as I mentioned, will meet in early November, and the East Coast Coordination Group, I think we finally picked a date. That was a tough one to schedule, but that's in November at some point. Next slide. Just wanted to highlight council actions and correspondence since our last meeting. Groundfish Framework 69 was submitted by the council to NOAA on March 11th. Herring specifications for 2025 to 2027 were submitted on May 6th. We still don't have proposed rules or final implementation of the actions associated with these council actions, and we did submit a couple of comments related to experimental fishing permits for Eastern Gulf of Maine Jig Survey and additional research in the Great South Channel Habitat Management Area for clam. Next slide. Before I take any questions, I just want to follow up on the chair's comment about the committee assignments. Please, if you could fill those out and have them turned in to Sherry by close of business tomorrow, that would be a big help. It's your top picks. You don't have to fill in all 5 rows. We're not going to think about putting anybody on more than 5 committees. I will note that the on-demand working group, when we get to that report later this week on Thursday, there will be a proposal to suspend work on that group for the remainder of 2025 with consideration for 2026 priority. So you don't need to fill in on-demand working group at this time as part of your committee assignments, but any of the other committees are on the table. And I will take any questions.
Jackie O'Dell.
Thanks, Kate, for the presentation and update. Quick question, I don't know if it's going to be for you regarding the NRCC discussion or whether it's going to be to Dr. Hare, but when will we know when the 2027 assessment schedule, what is that looking like, and when will we have more clarity around what that plan is coming out of the Science Center? Was there any clarification given to on timeline given to the NRCC?
Thanks for the question, Jackie. That's a part of the goal of the November NRCC meeting. That's probably our biggest agenda item, is trying to plan for 2027 and beyond, and trying to take a more holistic view of, you know, right now we're kind of in this like year by year triage phase and understanding what the capacity in the region is. I think the goal for NRCC is to get to a point where we can be a little bit more long-term in our planning. We had been planning for 5 years at a time. we may not get back to that length of time, but trying to be a little bit more holistic. We anticipate that we will get updated information from the center at that NRCC meeting to help us make those decisions around capacity and what we can do.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Dr. O'Keefe. Moving on to Regional Administrator's update, Mike Pentney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations on your election. So I have a few things to note, most of which you probably are already aware of, but one thing you may not be, so we'll touch on that at the end. So on August 7th, we published a temporary rule for herring in a Management Area 1A that implemented a 2,000-pound possession limit, basically following the regulations that indicate when we project that we've reached 92% of the sub-ACL, we reduce the possession limit. So that will be in effect until December 31st, unless we are able to publish the final rule for the revised herring specs, at which point we would increase the herring 1A sub-ACL and potentially reopen the fishery once we balance the books. People may be curious about the scallop research set-aside program. All we can really say at this point is that the notice of funding opportunity for next year is still pending NOAA, final NOAA approval. Once it is approved, it will be open for 60 days while we will be soliciting proposals. On September 15th, we published a temporary rule for the Atlantic mackerel fishery, closing the commercial mackerel fishery effective September 16th. And that's because the regulations require that we implement the closure once we project that 80% of the domestic annual harvest has been attained. The possession limit for limited access mackerel vessels is reduced to 10,000 pounds per trip. And the mackerel possession limit for open access mackerel vessels is reduced to 2,500 pounds per trip. Vessels may only land mackerel once per calendar day, and that will be in place through the end of the calendar year. Today, we're actually publishing the final rule for the 2025 and 2026 mackerel, squid, and butterfish specifications. So this action sets new and projected 2026 butterfish quota, so it increases the 2025 butterfish quota, but it reaffirms the already projected 2025 specifications for chub mackerel, ilex squid, longfin squid, and mackerel. But it also reduces the possession limit, I'm sorry, not the possession limit, the minimum size for square mesh used on directed butterfish trawl trips. So it used to be 3 inches. Well, it's still 3 inches. It will be 2 5/8 inches. And we can probably talk offline if you have any questions about that, because it's rather cumbersome to explain. But the final rule for that will be effective October 23rd. So we actually have the 30-day delay of effectiveness on that. The last thing to mention is that in July, we received a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity to list cusk as threatened or endangered under the provisions of the Endangered Species Act. And also, they also requested that we designate critical habitat for cusk. So we're reviewing the petition, and there's a specific process that we have to follow under Section 4 of the ESA. First, we have to determine whether the petition presents substantial scientific or commercial information indicating that the petition may be warranted. So if we conclude that the petitioned action may be warranted, which is not to say that listing may be warranted, but just that the status review may be warranted, then we publish a Federal Register notice and solicit comments from the public prior to commencing that status review. If we conclude that the petitioned action is not warranted based on the information presented, then we deny the petition and no further action is taken. In either case, we announce our determination in the Federal Register. It's called a 90-day finding, but quite often they take longer than 90 days in order to get everything settled and published. And we have more information about the petition on our webpage if you're interested in reading about that. And that's all I have, although I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pitney. Actually, before I open up to questions, I do have a question. Obviously, you expect this coming. Is Framework 69, the status of that? The reason why I highlight this is, as a ground fish sector manager in my other world, you know, what I've been seeing from the industry and the lease world is that guys are paying somewhat inflated lease prices on stocks that we were expecting to have significant increases this year, talking specifically about Witch Flounder and Gulf of Maine Haddock. I mean, it's obviously the expectation here is that we were supposed to have these increases starting May 1, and I just want to highlight, without these increases right now, this is leading to inflated costs to the industry that should not be on the table. So anything that you can do to kind of spur this along and make sure that people understand that this is actually costing the industry in the long run, you know, monetarily. So I just wanted to point that out. Questions? I see Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, I'd like to thank my fellow members around the table for electing me to the executive committee. Thank you for your support. My question has to do, Mr. Pentany, with CUSC. What is the timeline for the public to comment on that, number one? And number two, will the council be providing any comment associated with that?
Yep, thanks for the question. So there will only be an opportunity for public comment if we determine the petition is warranted, and then we'll publish a notice in the Federal Register announcing our finding that the petition may be warranted, and that will open up a public comment period. Probably, I don't know the specific timeline, whether it will be 60 days, 90 days, or something like that, but we would make sure that there was an opportunity to brief the council during that window on more details about what's in the proposal, the basis for our, if we do decide that the petition may be warranted, the basis for that determination, and then, you know, solicit information and perspectives from the council as well as the public that we would then use as we go through the status review process, which can take a year. If we do a negative 90-day finding, then we simply announce in the Federal Register that the petition is not warranted and no further action is being considered.
No, thank you.
Jackie O'Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Mike, for the update. So just getting back to Framework 69, I think a lot of us had hoped that there would be, and we're waiting for it to go through the Federal Register and for a proposed rule to be released sometime over the summer. Obviously, that hasn't happened yet. Hopefully, that will happen soon. So that brings us now, we're getting close to the emergency action expiring and needing to be renewed. And I'm wondering if you could just explain to us what that would look like. And then I'm assuming if and when the proposed rule comes out on Framework 69 and then gets implemented by the agency, that would immediately override any emergency rule renewal. So obviously you're going to have to work on two things at once now. The Framework 69, getting that to be implemented, and then also, but you're going to have to think about the timing of when you start the second clock for the emergency action. And I guess I don't know what happens between that process and whether the emergency action could be renewed to reflect some of the provisions that are in Framework 69 or like increases on Haddock or Witch Flounder, or if it would just be renewed as it was implemented on May 1st. Thanks.
So first off, in general, we don't really know what's going to happen. All along, our plan had been that the proposed rule for Framework 69 would publish in the spring, summer. Then we would take comments and make a decision on Framework 69 for a final rule. And the final rule for Framework 69 would have included any extension to the emergency rule that was necessary. So it would have been one rule, very clean, all of the allocations, all of the new specs, including the emergency measures necessary related to COD. That seems to be off the table, given that we're a month away and there's no proposed rule yet. So it's not clear exactly what we would be doing. If we were to publish a standalone extension of the emergency rule, that would only extend the measures in the emergency rule. So we would not be able to pull in any of the measures that are part of Framework 69, including all of the quota increases, the waiver of the management uncertainty buffer, sector exemptions. All of those changes would have to wait for Framework 69 to be approved and implemented before any of those could go into effect. There were also a few other things that we were looking at doing in the final rule to try to provide some relief to the industry on a couple issues that we can't do until we get the final rule ready. And I don't have any estimate on timing for that. As well, the potential for a government shutdown October 1st, not knowing if that happens, how long it might last, also complicates this whole process. So unfortunately, we are in kind of unprecedented waters in terms of what might happen and what the sequence will be.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Pettine. Next up, General Counsel, I'll kick it over to Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of substantive updates. One is a case decision, and the other is a new case that was filed on a state matter that I will describe, and then some procedural updates for cases that have been ongoing. The first update involves the Relentless Incorporated versus Department of Commerce case that was a companion case to Loper Bright and was before the Supreme Court when Loper Bright was decided, and they were both decided on the same grounds, and then they were kicked back down after the Supreme Court said, hey, courts, when you're deciding, when you're looking at an agency action, do not defer to their interpretation of the statute. You should use your own best judgment. And so they said, okay, now that we've told you that, go back and look at this Loper Bright and look at this Relentless case in light of that new instruction and determine whether those the agency's interpretation is the best interpretation of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And you may recall Relentless Incorporated and Loper Bright were looking at the industry-funded monitoring program in the herring fishery and potentially with larger implications. The Relentless case was remanded to the First Circuit, which then sent it back down to the District Court in Rhode Island. And on July 15th, the District Court ruled that in favor of the government and denied the plaintiff's arguments and said that the Magnuson-Stevens Act indeed does support industry-funded monitoring, and there is a text in the Act that supports it. Since that time, on September 3rd, the plaintiffs in that case have filed an appeal with the First Circuit Court of Appeals for them to go ahead and they want to challenge it before that circuit court and retest that finding again. In a separate matter, there's a new case that was filed in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, and this is the Cape Cod Charter Boat Association et al. Versus the ASMFC. And in that case, the plaintiffs are challenging striped bass regulations that they're saying are hurting the fishery. And this was filed, the complaint was filed in May. Since that time, the other thing is that they're seeking for relief to get rid of those striped bass regulations, and they're also seeking to get rid of the ASMFC and any other regulations that came from the AFC since its creation. There were motions to dismiss and motions for other actions that have been filed by the parties. Those have been briefed and there's a, or they're in the process of being briefed, and the court has scheduled a hearing on those motions on October 21st. And a couple of procedural updates. You may recall that the New England Fishermen Stewardship Association had challenged Framework 65 and challenged it on the basis of constitutional claims that the council was improperly constituted by council members that should not be federal officers in violation of the Constitution. That case was won at the district court. There was an appeal to the First Circuit. That briefing is underway, and the final brief before the First Circuit's consideration and decision is due by, NEFSA has got to respond by October 21st. At that time, the court will take into consideration the briefs, may have an oral argument, and then they will they'll decide the case at some point. The other procedural update is that the Loper-Bright case, there was a joint motion in July to hold the case in abeyance that was filed by both parties. And on August 13th, the court, the D.C. Circuit Court, granted that motion and is holding its decision. If you may recall, that was remanded to the D.C., the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals. They had taken all the briefing and the argument, and they were a decision was pending. The parties decided to file a joint motion to hold that decision in abeyance so that they could have discussions about the case. There's a status report that's due on November 12th to the court, and then every at 90-day intervals after that. Last, there is a case that was filed in the District of Maine originally, and that was a case that was challenging a state imposition of electronic devices that tracked lobster vessels. The Maine District Court dismissed that case, but the parties, the plaintiffs in that case, appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. That has been briefed, and on July 28th, the First Circuit heard oral arguments in that case, and they are now deciding the case, and at some point will issue a decision. And that's it, Mr. Chair. I'll take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Attorney McDonald. Any questions for Mitch? Jackie O'Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually not a question for Mitch, even though thank you very much for the update. But I just wanted to ask, there are some folks that are in the audience that wanted to ask Mr. Petney some questions about Framework 69. I don't know if you typically take public comments on updates or if that would be considered after the updates are given, but I just wanted to make note that there were some interested folks who wanted to comment. Thanks. And thanks, Mitch, for the update.
Thank you. I'm not going to take comments now on it. If it comes up during groundfish or tomorrow during open public comment meeting, but not at this point. Thank you. No other questions for Attorney McDonald. I will kick it over to Dr. Hare for the Science Center report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Happy to be back in person. Updates on surveys first, sort of closing the loop on one of the issues that I raised at the last council meeting. As you may remember, I reported that HABCAM was lost during the HABCAM survey on June 9th. It was recovered on July 27th using an ROV from NOAA ship Henry Bigelow. Just want to, again, provide thanks to the RSA program and RSA partners, in particular Kunimesset Farm Foundation, for rejuggling the survey plan, survey work, and completing much of the Science Center's planned HABCAM tracks. Jonathan Peros, Ryan Silva, group council, regional office all worked very hard together to make that happen. Bottom trawl survey, leg one is out. Bigelow was in Moorhead City avoiding some weather and then also repairing a pump. She's back out working now, making her way back north, has completed a good amount of work. She comes in at the end of this week, and then leg two is scheduled to sail on October 1st. There are the uncertainties that Mr. Pentney alluded to that we're trying to work through and to keep that survey going. Gulf of Maine bottom longline survey is on track. They're looking to sail mid-October. And our ecosystem monitoring survey is also on track, looking to sail at the end of October, early November. I do just want to note, although bluefin tuna is not a New England Council managed species, Northeast Center, working with Southeast Center, successfully executed a cruise this summer, working off the shelf, and was able to collect thousands of bluefin tuna larvae. And that information will be used in the bluefin tuna assessment, and it clearly indicates that bluefin tuna are spawning in the Northeast region. That survey has been a long time coming, and just want to thank the support which we got for that survey, largely coming from individuals in the state of Maine. So thank you very much. In terms of cooperative research, Anna Mercer is going to be here tomorrow giving an update on cooperative research, so I'm not going to provide any more information on that or on Northeast Trawl Advisory Panel. Chairman Salerno will give an update this after this, and then Dr. Mercer will provide more information tomorrow. In terms of observer programs, we had the executive committee, there was a conversation, a question about some notification that was sent by the Science Center to the council, whether there was any council action needed. And no, there was not any council action needed. That communication was sent in August, just announcing that the C-Day schedule for the NEFOP program was available. It was late, and I think that's where the misunderstanding came from. So typically we release that in sort of April, May. This year it was August, so it was just setting the C-Day schedule for NEFOP, and I just wanted to clarify that. In terms of the NEFOP program itself, they're on track. They've got, 80% of their coverage has been accomplished, and working to finish out a year. We also were able to successfully award a new contract for the Northeast Fishery Observer Program that includes the port sampling. And so that is something that, we've been working with the regional office and working with NRCC for, 2 years to make that happen. And so it has happened. The contract has been awarded, which is excellent. And so now we need to work to, make advantage of that new arrangement to increase the port sampling to as much as we possibly can, but that is good news. In terms of the at-sea monitoring program, the current realized coverage rate is 88%, so that is also working well. And thank you to all the groundfish vessels that participate in that program. In terms of electronic monitoring, which can be used in lieu of an at-sea monitor, there are currently 38 approved vessels enrolled in the audit model program, and there are 5 vessels in process of enrollment, so that the EM as an option continues to grow. In terms of our assessments, an express appreciation to Kate O'Keefe and Jamie Cornain for helping work through the revision to the 2025 assessment schedule, the revision to the 2026 assessment schedule, and then looking forward to what is our new long-term schedule. So that will be a conversation. The 26 has been decided, and the conversation about 27 and forward will happen at the November NRCC meeting. In terms of the management track assessment, as Dr. O'Keefe stated, we did have a management track last week. All the assessments passed, and I'm sure you'll be learning more about those assessments as they work their way through. The next step is an SSC meeting and review, and we're working to get all the materials provided to the council before October 1st. Not sure if we're going to be able to meet that deadline, but everyone is working very hard to do that, to allow you to continue your work that you have planned. On the research track assessment, there was a peer review for the American Lobster Research Track early September, and that assessment passed peer review. And then, as we heard earlier, we have the Longfin Squid Research Track with the peer review in March, and then the following management track assessment in the spring of 2026. We are continuing to sort of track the updates in the MRIP program, which is the Recreational Catch Statistics Program. We are expecting revised MRIP data at some point in 2026. And then we would be expecting to use that revised data in stock assessments in 2027. And we're still tracking that. And I think the MRIP program is still on track with meeting that deadline. Protected species, we are conducting aerial surveys. State of Maine is conducting aerial surveys. We have several other groups conducting aerial surveys, so the coverage is much greater in this region. The real-time detections are reported on whalemap.org, and then the regional office will put in the dynamic management zones around detections, and so that effort is underway and continues. There have been very few right whale sightings in the New England and Mid-Atlantic region in August and September, but we expect sightings to increase again as the reproductive females are moving south to their calving grounds off of Georgia and Florida. Now, we're going to hear more about the sort of developments with on-demand gear later in the meeting. There are currently 47 fixed gear vessels participating in our development program, and we have 18 mobile vessels that are testing the digital gear detection technology, and then we have 9 other fishermen who are collaborators but are not currently active. The lending library at the Science Center has 750 devices, which are available to loan people who want to try them out, work with them. And the collaborators, we've done about 16,000 hauls with on-demand gear since 2020. And it's the third season of our experimental fishery with a 94% success rate in terms of retrieving gear first time, but also retrieving gear that doesn't come up with the acoustic release. And Eric Mattson from the Science Center presented an on-demand update to the Atlantic States Lobster Board on the 5th of August, and also engaged in a council meeting, I believe that was last week. In terms of offshore wind, there's obviously a lot going on with offshore wind nationally and regionally. The Science Center continues to work to address the survey mitigation issue. And we are working with the sort of NOAA hierarchy to try to make sure that we are in step with administration actions on offshore wind. And then the regional monitoring standards for offshore wind projects was presented at the council, and we are working to put that out for a public review in the coming weeks. And so once that is available for public comment, we will make sure to notify the council. Lastly, marine carbon dioxide removal. The experiment by HUI, Loch Ness Project, some of you may remember that was conducted in Wilkinson Basin. The project had two goals: to evaluate the ability to monitor changes in ocean alkalinity and subsequent carbon dioxide uptake by the ocean resulting from alkaline solution additions, and two, to collect scientific information to better understand any potential adverse impacts to human health, the marine environment, and other uses of the ocean. So Northeast Center will continue tracking that new ocean use, and we'll continue just providing brief updates here if warranted. And so with that, I will end my report, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Hare. Questions for Dr. Hare? I see Bill Lucy.
Yes, thank you for the great update. Just a quick question on the government shutdown and the potential impacts on the Bigelow. Has it ever been, or could it potentially be, considered essential services and allowed to continue regardless of the shutdown?
We are working on that pathway. So we are working to request all of the survey activities that I reported to you as mission critical. And so then now we've put the request in, and so now we need to wait and hear as to whether they've been accepted as mission critical or not. And I would expect to hear either Monday or Tuesday of next week. But we're telling our survey staff to plan as if they're going to sail.
Eric Hansen.
A very related question. Miss Lucy beat me to the punch, but now my question is, if the trawl survey is suspended, how long would it have to be suspended before it's scrapped? I'm sure the Bigelow has other commitments, and you know, you did allude to the priority of it, but you know, I'm fearful that the second leg would be scrapped and we'd have nothing for the New England region.
So that type of contingency planning, unfortunately, we have gotten better and better at. And so, you know, if we start losing days, then we start prioritizing areas and prioritizing the remaining days that we have. And so if the trawl survey does not sail for its second leg, the second leg, we have been sailing 3 20-day legs. But our second leg this year we're splitting in two with a small boat transfer. So if there is a shutdown and we restart quickly, it's possible that we would lose a couple of days or that one part of the second leg and then have the full second part of the second leg and third leg to work with. And so that type of contingency planning will begin once we have an idea of what's happening with the shutdown. But we still have, at the end of this leg, we still have 40 days available, which is enough time to complete the survey area if there are no more delays.
Okay, that's helpful. I mean, we do have a 40-day window for a 20-day cruise. Is that?
Well, it's a 60-day cruise, and we have a 60-day window. But there, you know, there is some weather and some maintenance worked into that window. If we shut down and we lose a good, you know, portion of the second leg, then we're going to be looking at reducing the survey area, needing to make the decisions about how best to use the time we have available. There's also always the possibility to try to extend days later into the year. That also has, then we're pushing outside of our standard sampling windows, and that has ramifications to data. But we have been asked to submit Bigelow as an exempted activity with the shutdown. So our next step is to see what happens with whether it's accepted or not, and then do we shut down or not. And then with those two answers, we can move into greater contingency planning if we need to.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And let's just hope that we don't have to do any of this contingency stuff.
Correct.
Next up, I have Jackie O'Dell and then Mike Pierdnock to follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Hare, for the update. So first, I just wanted to note to you that I was able to listen into the sector manager call that they have with the agency, and I just thank you to your staff for continuing to work on making sure that there are contracts in place for the at sea monitoring money. I know there's been a lot of log jams going on lately and unknowns with monies or when contracts expire and how to add, you know, the new money or available money onto, you know, new contracts. And I just want to thank your staff for really working through that and giving the sectors an update for, at the last meeting, it was roughly, I think, like 14 months at the existing coverage rate that there was enough money to cover with the days that they had estimated. Looks like there's enough money available now to cover at-sea monitoring at up to 100%. Obviously, if we change that, or Mr. Petney changes that it would be able to get us through longer through next fishing year. But at least we know now that we're not going to run out of money this winter. At least we have a year to work towards that. So that's good to know. If there's not additional money in the federal appropriations moving forward. So thanks to you and your staff for staying on top of that.
I may just comment for a minute. Thank you.
Yeah, because it has,
you know, contracting and grants, you know, new processes this year, and everyone needed to learn new approval processes. So I appreciate that. A lot of work was put into that contract in particular, but, you know, all of our contracts. So thank you.
So thanks for that. Second, I just wanted to quickly note on the port side sampling. Good to hear that that's moving forward as well. I'm curious if, in addition to kind of securing that program, if there's going to be any design modifications to that program to allow biological samples to be taken by vessels that are fishing in multiple broad stock areas. That's been a notable issue for groundfish. I think it was last year or the year before, there were no samples for Georges Bank cod in the U.S., and we had to borrow from Canadian aging information and other biological information. So that need to collect, especially as we're moving forward with four new cod management areas, we need to make sure that we have a system where we're be able to collect biological data on vessels fishing in multiple broad stock areas. So I'm hoping, I asked some of your staff if there was any movement on that. I think there have been internal discussions on that, but I just wanted to reiterate the importance of collecting that biological samples for management.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And similar to, you know, Mr. Hansen's question, is, you know, the way I approach things is one step at a time. You got to look ahead, but first thing was getting the contract. So now the contract's been approved, it's been awarded, and we have the two next steps are, one, working with sectors to collect samples from areas that we haven't been able to collect, and two is evaluating and working more closely with the states. ASMFC, there is the state workshop, might be this week, to sort of look at the state question and what we can do in terms of leveraging, working with the states to improve our regional port sampling. And then the next piece, as I say, is sort of talking more with sectors. There were some trials and some work that was done there. And now that the, you know, we've got the contracting piece done, we'll get through next week, and then we can start thinking about, you know, how do we sort of strengthen that sector involvement to get the samples that we need. So I appreciate the comments, so noted, and we'll be working on that.
Mr. Pierdock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Hare. Thank you for that update of the bluefin tuna larva study. That is a great example of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, Southeast Fisheries Science Center, the commercial for-hire recreational fleet, and the private sector all coming together to make it happen. That's an area noted as the Slope Sea that for many years, going way back, the public has pointed that fact that that is a spawning area for bluefin tuna, and the results that came out are tremendous and provides additional lines of evidence that it is taking place in that area. I noticed that September 19th, the link came out with all the details. That's a great source to go there. But, you know, thank you for all your efforts pulling that together, making it happen, communicating with everybody, the funding, the whole thing, because that took a lot to make that happen. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I understand it's not a New England Council species, but I think it is a, you know, a good example of how the Northeast Fisheries Science Center wants to work in the future and work now. And as cooperatively, it's engaging with all parties, trying to do the best science we can. I don't remember, I was just going to check on my phone. I was like, well, that's rude to interrupt Mike and check on my phone. I mean, that paper was published in 2018. The plan for this survey and the plan for the long line component of it was developed basically right when that paper was put out. So we've had these plans on the shelf since 2018. Have been working to find a way to support the research. And then in 2024, there was directed budget language to do this work. Couldn't be done in 24 because we didn't have time to execute the contracts and the grants. So we carried the funding over to 25, and we're finally able to execute it in 25. So it's, you know, arguably 8 years in the making. But it, you know, comes down to, you know, people keeping the idea and keeping the willingness to work together, and the patience to, you know, to keep to work together when the opportunity presents to be able to go. So thank you for your comments.
Melanie Griffin.
Yeah, I just wanted to reflect on Jackie's questions and comments about sampling across broad stock areas. And yesterday was the first day of that state federal workshop, and I know a bunch of the states gave presentations, and certainly Dr. Dean gave a presentation on some ongoing work that's been in partnership with the sectors and some other groups to pilot an approach to allow for that. So I think we're going to hear a report from that at the next NRCC, so maybe some information for you there, Jackie.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Dr. Hare. Next up is the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council report. That's actually me, so give me a second. So Mid-Atlantic Council met in August. The meeting notes and a little more in-depth of what I'm going to give you is under tab 9. They met in mid-August in Annapolis, Maryland. I met from my home office because I wasn't going to Annapolis for the summer. Couple things to note. They did elect Joe Cimino as their new chair and Skip Feller as their new vice chair. They sworn new members Lisa Woolahan from Delaware, Todd Janeski from Virginia, and Jake Wiscott from New Jersey. And they also reappointed Scott Lennox from Maryland. Several reports that they had, one we actually you'll be getting from me later today, is they got an updated on the latest NTAP report. They also received the Atlantic Scallop Research Track Assessment Report, which we all received back in June. Additional reports that they received was a presentation on the white paper on the sector specifics, OFLs, and ABCs. Basically, they agreed to not prioritize any development at this time, basically looking at a commercial versus recreational type OFL slash ABC for their Fluke's Gut Black Sea Bass FMP. They also got a presentation on a conceptual alternatives and preliminary analysis for the recreational sector separation amendment, and they did remove two options from further consideration. That related to the separate allocations option as well as the temporary limitation on ability to renew inactive federal permits. Actions that they took at their meeting, they did approve their list of recommendations for Executive Order 14276. They set specifications 2026 through 2028 for the ILEC squid fishery, and 2026 through 2027, summer flounder, scup, black sea bass, and bluefish, those four stocks in conjunction with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. They also initiated a framework to consider modifications to the Atlantic mackerel rebuilding approach, as well as they formed a joint subcommittee with the South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council on blue line tidal fish allocations north of Cape Hatteras while still moving forward with the 2026 specs approved in June. And that's all I have. I've turned to Robert Rule to see if he has anything to add from that meeting.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think you pretty much covered it, and actually you remembered a lot more than I did.
Thank you. Any questions for Mid-Atlantic report? I should go back to here. Mike Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question just has to do with the mackerel modifications. When is the next step in the timeline for that? And are they looking to reduce or go up, or is there any sense of where that may end up?
Now, this is where my memory may be a little suspect, and we can look into this. But I believe it was just initiating the action to start looking at the specifications that are currently on the process, looking to possibly changing the rebuilding targets. I think it's up in the air right now because they just initiated it, so I think it's kind of an explore and see which way it would go. I think the intention was to kind of look at, is there an opportunity to maybe give somewhat higher levels of allocation in the future, but I think, you know, that's still preliminary in their work right now. No other questions for me. Awesome. So I will kick it over to Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Tony Kearns, who is remote. Are you out there, Tony? Oh, I see a hand. We're unmuting you right now.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations on your new role. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission will be meeting the week of October 27th through the 30th in Dewey Beach, Delaware. And We'll have a couple of stock assessments presented to the commission, one being a update of the Tatog stock. We'll also have a benchmark and peer review of both the American Lobster and the Atlantic Menhaden and the ERP reference points for Menhaden. And they'll be making decisions on the striped bass management board for the 2026 fishery and beyond on reducing harvest for the striped bass fishery to meet the rebuilding goal of 2029. And then in addition, the Atlantic Days Out states met recently for Atlantic herring, and the three states of Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts set some provisional landing days for season two, and they are all contingent on whether or not quota moves into that fishery or not. So if no quota moves into the fishery, the landing days will stay at zero. If we get 1,000 metric tons transferred over from the Canadian Weir fishery, then we will move to two consecutive landing days. Those landing days will start Wednesday, November 5th, and be on Wednesdays and Thursdays. And then if we receive an increase in the quota, as was requested by both the Commission and the New England Council, we will move to, the two landing days will be if we get the additional quota as was requested by the council and the commission. If we do not get that, but we do get the 1,000 metric tons from the Weir fishery, then we'll only go to one landing day. And those landing days in either case will start November 5th. In addition to the landing days, the days out states also requested that the commission send a letter to the Secretary of Commerce asking for that increase in the quota to move through the process in as quick of a manner as possible, as we are running out of time for the end of the fishing year, and we want to make sure that that fishery has the ability to utilize that quota if it's going to come into the fishery. We are also interested if the council is interested in sending that letter with us, or having two letters go that are in similar in nature. And that's all I have to report.
Thank you, Ms. Kearns. Any questions? Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Tony. Just a quick question related to striped bass. When is the juvenile index for the Chesapeake Bay due in? I'm just curious of where that falls in relation to the decision-making process for 2026.
There is no specific date in which the index comes in, but typically we have Maryland's index come in prior to the annual meeting. So I anticipate that we will get it in the coming weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you. So there was a question out there to council members here about a potential letter, a shared letter between this council and AFSMSC, really requesting, prompting the agency about these Atlantic herring specifications. I'm just looking around the table if there's any interest in pursuing something like that. Sorry. Melanie.
I would absolutely be in support of that, yeah.
Dr. O'Keefe.
Thank you. Just a clarification. So this would be a tasking to write a joint letter between the New England Council and Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission on asking the status of the 2025 to 2027 specifications, or what is exactly in the letter, please?
Yeah, the request at the Days Out meeting was more urging, timely publication soon. I'm not certain, the fine line that we have to walk, but certainly if it has to be more of a just pointing out the facts, fine. But, as Tony said, time's running out on this. And this is quota that we had approved for the fishery. So I think it's time for us to, it would be helpful to have a joint letter, I think.
Thank you. So it sounds like AFSMSC and New England Council work together to put something together. At least that's my read of it. Okay. Thank you. No other questions for Ms. Kearns? All set. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See you in a couple days.
Thank you. Next up is U.S. Coast Guard with Captain John Singletary for his report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. We are very happy to be here, and hopefully we can add some value to this process. For everyone's knowledge, we have changed the Coast Guard 1st District to the Coast Guard Northeast District in alignment with DOD practices throughout the Coast Guard. Introduction-wise, I have Lieutenant Tom Blyfus. He is my fisheries law enforcement subject matter expert. We have Mr. Chris Sparkman from Vessel Inspections. And then today we also have Lieutenant Ricky Moore. He is the new commanding officer of the Regional Fisheries Training Center on Cape Cod. So it's great to have him here. Please take advantage of their expertise and your breaks. And with that said, I'll turn it over to Tom for the Coast Guard report.
Thank you, Captain. Next slide, please. Since June 2025, the Coast Guard's conducted 178 fishing vessel boardings, issued 35 violations for an observed compliance rate of 84%. Of note, it's not just on the 178. Some of the boardings resulted in multiple violations. Next slide. Violation breakdown, 6 documentation-related, 15 reporting/notifications, 3 VMS violations, and 11 species or area. For safety side, we've conducted 209 dockside exams with 184 decals issued, again, 178 boardings, 39 safety violations on board 20 individual vessels, and 4 commercial fishing vessel safety terminations due to safety during this period for an observed compliance rate of 89%. Violation breakdown, 5 EPIRB-related, 16 survival craft, 8 flare, 2 firefighting, and 8 documentation numbering placards or drills on board. For search and rescue, Coast Guard responded to 70 fishing vessel incidents to include 13 disabled vessels, 2 elisions, 6 fires, 6 vessels aground, taken on water, lost on rocks, resulting in 45 lives saved. There were 4 medevac or medicos and 3 fishing-related deaths. Pending any questions, Mr. Chairman, that concludes Coast Guard report. Over.
Thank you, Lieutenant Blyfus. Any questions for either Captain Singletary or Lieutenant Blyfus? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, and thank you for the work you do on behalf of the fishing industry. Thank you. Next up is NOAA Enforcement, Caleb Gilbert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Congratulations to you and the other selectees and appointees. My name is Caleb Gilbert. I'm the compliance liaison for the Northeast Division of NOAA Fisheries Office of Law Enforcement. I have a couple details I plan to share with the council today. Our priorities continue to be trade enforcement, North Atlantic right whale enforcement, supporting our Northeast Fisheries Observer partners, as well as enforcing MSA Act or MSA regulations. I'll start with a brief update on our trade enforcement work since the June meeting. I don't have any specific enforcement metrics to share today, but related casework continues, including inspections and subsequent investigations conducted in Michigan, our Michigan-based EO on major ports of entry in his area of responsibility, in particular Chicago and Detroit ports of entry. Recently concluded trade enforcement cases have ranged in the penalty spectrum from written warnings to summary settlements, and most recently a yellowfin tuna importer paid a summary settlement earlier this month for circumventing seafood import monitoring program, harvesting vessel information reporting requirements. In addition, our sworn staff regularly team up with agents and officers from partner agencies on our container shipment and trade enforcement related inspections, such as from U.S. Customs Border Patrol, U.S. FDA, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as our state enforcement partners. We continue to focus our trade enforcement efforts on all 13 seafood import monitoring, SIMP, listed species groups such as shrimp, tuna, abalone, et cetera. One more trade enforcement case I can highlight today that closed recently that involved a Boston and Chicago-based seafood broker who violated their biweekly bluefin tuna reporting requirements, failing to submit reports on 303 tuna shipments between July 31st, 2021 and March 31st, 2024. Moving on to our enforcement support of North Atlantic right whale conservation, there's been a lot of activity since the last council meeting. Our sworn staff continue processing speed rule cases to reduce the incidence of vessel strikes by vessels 65 foot and above. Earlier this month, we sent out 498 letters to vessel owners for AIS-indicated speed rule violations. On the Atlantic large whale take reduction plan enforcement side of our North Atlantic right whale conservation efforts, those are the efforts to reduce gear interactions. As of early August, our D1 enforcement officers completed the third mid-range fixed gear patrol of the year. All three of those patrols were conducted in different areas within LMA, Lobster Management Area 1. On the most recent patrol, officers inspected 325 traps. Continuing in reverse order, I'll just give you a few metrics on those patrols. 2 weeks prior, our D1 EOs conducted the second mid-range patrol of the year, hauling 12 trawls, and two D1 EOs conducted the first mid-range fixed gear patrol of the year at the end of June, and on that patrol inspected 10 trawls. Our officers observed low take reduction plan compliance on all three inshore patrols. In addition, I've heard a couple reports from the fishing community directly asking about these patrols, so I know that our sworn staff's work on these patrols is being noticed on the water, at least by some folks. Offshore, we still continue those patrols on a contracted platform patrol vessel. We completed our second multi-day offshore patrol of the year in the middle of July. That took place actually in our D2 area of responsibility. That's the first mid-Atlantic based multi-day offshore fixed gear patrol since we began conducting these patrols back in 2020. Yes, up until that patrol, all of our contracted offshore patrols had been conducted in LMA3, Lobster Management Area 3, off the coast of New England. Moving on to our enforcement support of the Observer Program, an Observer safety case closed mid-summer with a paid summary settlement after a vessel ran aground with an Observer on board in mid-January of last year. We also closed an Observer interference case with compliance assistance earlier this month. Our Observer Program liaison special agent also continues to provide new Observer training support. Participated in a training event that took place in mid-June, and most recently another one that was held in the first week of August. I'll mention a couple related to VMS cases. A couple VMS cases that also recently closed. Last year, a vessel owner paid a NOVA, Notice of Violation Assessment, for a Closed Area 2 incursion. That case also involved the U.S. Coast Guard D1 Aerial Surveillance Patrol. This July, General Counsel Enforcement Section issued a NOVA to an owner-operator, in addition to other violations such as failure to declare into PTNS. A VMS-indicated Western Gulf of Maine Habitat Management Area closed area violation. And last July, a vessel owner paid a NOVA fine for a Western Gulf of Maine incursion. The final highlight I'll mention today is the conclusion of a successful NOAA-led, organized and executed two-day multi-species, highly migratory species operation with New Jersey and New York JEA state partners. We wanted to highlight this operation today as it's a great example of the teamwork that exists between NOAA, OLE, and our state partners to ensure sustainable harvest of domestic seafood to protect American fishermen. Sworn staff conducted this operation on July 25th and 26th in a patrol area that consisted of the majority of navigable coastal inlets between Cape May, New Jersey, and Montauk, New York. Eight NOAA, OLE personnel participated in the operation. Total officers conducted 87 boardings. 63 of those were HMS boardings in federal waters and 24 were state water boardings. And they identified five HMS violations on the operation and nine state violations. Nine JEA vessels participated in the first day of the op and eight on the second day, both split between New York and New Jersey state enforcement assets. And that's all I have to report today, Mr. Chairman. I'm more than happy to take any questions if folks have them.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Any questions? All set. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, Mr. Pierdnak with HMS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Highland Migratory Species Advisory Panel met in Silver Springs September 3rd and 4th. If you go on the council webpage, it will provide a link for the presentations and all the details associated with those meetings. My focus will be primarily on those species that impact the northeastern New England. There was, which the meetings were primarily dominated by bluefin tuna. There was some other presentations associated with economics and mobilid rays, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, that are prohibited retention, which is primarily down in Puerto Rico. But if you want more details about that, just go into that linked webpage. Bluefin tuna, as I said, dominated the meetings. Just a little summary of what occurred in 2024. The U.S. quota was exceeded for bluefin tuna. The general category, harpoon category, and recreational categories, all three exceeded their quota. To note, the general category and the harpoon category were provided an uptick in reserve. There's a reserve category that you can use to get more quota, and they were given that, and unfortunately that was exceeded. Recreational category was exceeded for the first time since 2010, but ultimately the U.S. quota has been exceeded. And that's problematic because there's a payback, and you must pay back 100% the following year. So in this season, or 2025, we already had cuts to quotas, which was also compounded by the fact that earlier this year in January, February, March, primarily down off of North Carolina, the North Carolina bite resulted in an exceedance of the general category bluefin tuna bite. So as a result, more cuts took place to the quotas, and unfortunately to the detriment of New England. New England has had a historical access to the bluefin tuna fishery that goes way back, and our quota reflects such. This year with the closures, there's been a sting up here to our New England fishery community, whether you're commercial or recreational, as a result of those cuts. For example, the general category bluefin tuna fishery, typically June, July, and August, they start with three fish. That was cut back to one. As a result of the reductions, the recreational category was shut down for a short time earlier in the year. I commend HMS for providing a four higher bag limit versus a recreational two versus one in an attempt to slow the catch down and keep the four higher at such to run a viable business. That shut down, unfortunately, the middle of August. Really what this represents is that the bluefin tuna fishery is just tremendous. Fish are located near shore. You no longer have to go 30, 40, 50 miles all the way to the Hague line to catch them. And we have a disconnect between what our U.S. quota is and what ICAT provides us. In an attempt to hopefully address this at the upcoming ICAT annual meeting in Sevilla, Spain in November, there's close kin DNA bluefin tuna sampling that's been occurring through Walt Gollett, University of Maine, where that data then is provided to show the level of mixing that is occurring between the eastern and western bluefin tuna stock. That science has been very favorable, and one hopes that we will be able to provide that science at ICAT to increase our quota. You first have to get past the science step, but then the next step is you have to get the 50 countries of ICAT to agree unanimously to do it. So we have a rough road ahead to make that happen, and we'll see where things turn out. Now, in the event there is no increase in the quota, there was discussions about some changes next year to how one could address the recreational seasons and bag limits, whether that's a regional management approach because to the detriment in New England, once again, the fishery was shut down and a lot of the fishing didn't really start up here because the fish didn't migrate into our waters at that point. So there's discussion of regional management, there's discussion of RFDs, as well as continued for-hire mode management versus the private sector. So we'll ultimately see where that goes, but that was up for discussion, and there'll be more to come. One other thing that came up, just to then close this up, and I appreciate it, you know, Captain Singletary mentioned to use them as a resource, and something came up at the HMS meeting that I reached out to Lieutenant Tom Blyfus as well as Caleb. There's some commercial vessels down in the Gulf that did not have satellite phones, but they had Starlink and Earthlink. And actually, they were unaware that they thought they were not in violation of the fact that they needed to have satellite phones. Ultimately, digging into this, if you're a recreational or for-hire vessel that's not inspected, one doesn't need satellite phones if you go, you know, offshore or beyond 25 miles. But if you're a commercial vessel that's uninspected, you require a satellite phone. So they didn't have that. They had Earthlink or Starlink, and technically it's not an authorized device by the U.S. Coast Guard. So from what I understand, the Gulf Council sent a letter to the Coast Guard requesting that they review to allow this. And, you know, we're all anxiously awaiting to see where that ends up. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but, you know, that ends my presentation. But thank you for your help, you and Caleb and your staff, for that. Thank you.
Lieutenant Blyfus?
I'd say update at this time is the Starlink personnel are engaged with Coast Guard Headquarters Approving Office to get that as an approved method of communication, but that's the only update I can offer.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Pierdnock? Seeing none, thank you, Mike. We're actually moving into a break right now. I just want to give a heads up that due to inclement potential weather tomorrow, we will be taking our council photo today on the beach instead of tomorrow with us and our umbrellas. So be prepared for before we break for lunch to meet outside on the lovely sandy beach there. So I'll give you 10 minutes. Let's be back here at 10:50.